Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Voices of Reform series, addressing issues surrounding California governance reform, made possible by the generous support of the James Irvine Foundation and co-sponsored by the Commonwealth Club's Young Professionals Group, InForum. I'm Zabre Valentine, Project Director for the Voices of Reform series, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio. And now it is my pleasure to turn tonight's program over to Rachel Gordon, a 15-year veteran of reporting the news here in San Francisco and the San Francisco Chronicle's senior reporter on issues related to City Hall. Ms. Gordon will moderate our discussion this evening.
Good evening. Next Tuesday, voters will put the system of ranked choice voting to the test in San Francisco in the races for 7 seats on the Board of Supervisors. Voters in the city approved the change more than 2 years ago, and after clearing several hurdles, regulatory, legal, technical, ranked choice voting is finally set to go. Rather than selecting just one candidate in each race, voters can mark their top 3 picks in order of preference. We'll find out just how the new system works a little later in our program. Although ranked choice voting, also known as instant runoff voting, has been used in other countries, San Francisco is the biggest test yet in the United States. Several other cities, including New York and Los Angeles, Seattle, are keeping close tabs on what happens here next Tuesday. Joining us tonight to discuss ranked choice voting and its anticipated impact on the upcoming election are Stephen Hill, founder and associate director of the Center for Voting and Democracy, and really one of the chief architects in ranked choice voting in San Francisco, and Dr. Richard De Leon, a political science professor at San Francisco State University, and for many reporters and others, the go-to expert on the city's political scene. Members of the audience at tonight's Commonwealth Club Forum will get a chance to ask guests questions, but I'm going to get the ball rolling right now with going to Professor De Leon and just asking you to walk us through of how this system works.
Okay, thank you, Rachel, and thanks also to the officers of the Distinguished Commonwealth Club for inviting me here to speak tonight. Stephen Hill is the national authority on ranked choice voting, and he knows a lot more about how this will work in San Francisco than I do, so I'll keep my own remarks brief. I do want to take this chance to plug his terrific book, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics. I think if anyone interested in this general topic, this is must-read. At least that's what I tell my students. What I'll do is give you at least a quick summary of how ranked choice voting will work in San Francisco. A little historical background, why I think this San Francisco election is really important, and also some of my own expectations, maybe I should say hopes, for what the process will look like and what the results will be. Now first, for those in the audience here and those who might be listening, what is ranked choice voting and how will it work, at least in San Francisco? As Rachel mentioned, in March 2002, the voters voted by 55% to approve the use of ranked choice voting for electing candidates to 7 citywide offices, including the mayor, and also for electing seats to the Board of Supervisors. Before now, in the November election for the Board of Supervisors, each voter in a district cast one vote for one candidate, and if no candidate won a majority of the votes cast, the top 2 vote-getters would face off in a December runoff election. Under the new ranked choice voting system in November, each voter still casts one vote, only now can indicate his or her first choice, second choice, and third choice preferences among the candidates. If no candidate receives a majority of first choice votes, the candidate receiving the fewest first choice votes is eliminated, and those votes are transferred to the remaining candidates according to the voter's second choice preferences. Another tally is then made, and if there's still no majority winner, the same process is repeated until a candidate receives a majority of the continuing votes and is declared the winner. All of this happens in the November election. when voter turnout is usually at its peak and all the candidates are on the menu. There's no need for a separate December runoff election, which are typically low turnout affairs and cost about $1 million a pop. San Francisco is a closely watched experiment in electoral reform and local democracy. It's received, as most of you here know, a lot of national attention and media coverage. New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, NPR. A lot of high-profile national political leaders like Howard Dean and John McCain have advocated for ranked choice voting, often called instant runoff voting. A lot of folks, particularly in the Bay Area, but also around the country in various cities and communities, are watching what happens in San Francisco with keen interest. Perhaps most of all, the citizens of Berkeley, who earlier this year in March voted 78%, I believe, to adopt ranked choice voting in their elections. But it's been stalled and put on hold, I should say, by the Alameda County officials until, you know, more can be learned about its feasibility, and especially some results can be gained from seeing how it works in San Francisco. So there's a lot of interest here in San Francisco, especially with its unique political culture, its receptivity to innovation and reform. It's always served, at least in the last quarter century, as a kind of national petri dish to test new ideas and innovations, and this is no exception. I often hear people say that this ranked choice voting idea, instant runoff voting, it's a new, strange, radical idea. It's somehow also un-American, vaguely European, even unpleasantly French. It's wrong. That's wrong on all counts. This ranked choice voting really is a very old idea. It can be traced back at least to Thomas Wright Hill, an English schoolmaster, who came up with the idea of ranked choice voting and certain ideas about proportional representation. And his notions were taken up later by Thomas Hare, an English barrister, in a pamphlet in 1859, proposing a pretty well thought out system of proportional representation. We political scientists call it single transferable vote system. And in his honor, the Hare system. And that pamphlet made a deep impression on no one less than John Stuart Mill, who hailed this new method of voting as a great leap forward for democracy and fair representation in his book, Considerations on Representative Government in 1861. So this is not something born yesterday. It's certainly not, as some critics evidently still believe, a Green Party plot hatched to divide and dismantle the venerable American two-party system. In terms of how American it is, it's actually as American as apple pie. Back in the Progressive Era, at the turn of the last century, it was ranked choice voting systems and various kinds of proportional representation systems were at the forefront of the progressive movement. The National Municipal League, which was the official voice and organizational spearhead of the progressive movement back then, actually recommended it as the preferred electoral system in their model city charter. And that was in 1914. In 1921, also recommended it for state elections. In 1956, shortly before it became the National Civic League, recommended it as the model county charter, the election system, preferred election system. In this country, 22 American cities during this period, let's say 1915 to 1956, actually used ranked choice voting in their elections. And these weren't just, little towns and villages. Big cities like Toledo, Cleveland, Cincinnati, for example, and others that have been studied carefully, all use ranked choice voting as part of the proportional representation systems in those cities. Now, of those 22 cities, only the city of Cambridge remains in terms of continuing to use this kind of system, at least now until San Francisco hits the road with it. There was one short-lived experiment with ranked choice voting, instant runoff elections for mayor in Ann Arbor, Michigan in 1975. And just a moment on that, because it is kind of instructive in some ways. In 1974, the voters passed a charter amendment adopting ranked choice voting for mayor, passed by 52% of the vote, came out of a petition drive by the Human Rights Party, more radical progressive party in Ann Arbor. In 1975, April 1975, the incumbent Republican mayor stood for re-election, who had won in the previous election by 47% of the vote, a plurality, not a majority. And as a consequence of the voters in the Human Rights Party and the Democratic Party splitting their votes, allowing the Republican candidate to win. In April 1975, under ranked choice voting, the Republican incumbent received 49% of the votes, not a majority. So the candidate, Human Rights Party candidate, receiving the least number of votes was eliminated. His votes were transferred according to second choice preferences, and nearly all of them went to the Democratic candidate. And the Democratic candidate won, becoming the Ann Arbor's first black mayor. In 1976, as a result of a Republican-engineered petition drive, the repeal of ranked choice voting was put on the ballot, and the voters, in a very low turnout election, repealed it. And we haven't heard from it since in Ann Arbor. But there are some lessons from this brief experiment with ranked choice voting in Ann Arbor. First, ranked choice voting system worked effectively to elect a mayor with majority vote. Second, all voters, but especially the Human Rights Party voters, were able to vote their true first choice preferences without fear of splitting the vote, spoiling things, and helping inadvertently to elect the greater of two evils. And third, electoral reforms don't last long if the reformers become complacent and fail to guard against attempts at repeal, as in this case. Now, coming back to San Francisco, there are a lot of other, there is some other more recent experience with ranked choice voting, but the experience of it back in the progressive era in real large American cities has pretty much been buried under three generations of collective amnesia. It was a good idea whose time had not yet come. It was easily repealed in many of these cities by Republican and Democrat-run big city machines whose fortunes were threatened by this kind of reform. Now it appears it's a good idea whose time has come, at least in San Francisco. It has been used in some universities like Stanford and UC Berkeley and Caltech and a number of others. I believe the Utah Republican Party uses it to nominate its congressional candidates and a number of other places. And Stephen can talk about some more recent and rather exciting news of its use in San Francisco. But San Francisco really is the big test case, the closely watched experiment. And I think it is an experiment that needs to be carefully, systematically, objectively studied in terms of its process and results and impacts, and the results widely shared. And in that regard, San Francisco State University's Public Research Institute is going to be conducting such a study, exit polls and other kinds of studies, and will report the results they get sometime later. And I've just heard that the Chinese American Voter Education Committee is also planning to conduct such an exit poll and an evaluation study of ranked choice voting, and it could be there are others. I think there is some anecdotal evidence that some of the claims made for ranked choice voting by advocates have merit, You know, for example, the claim that ranked choice voting is going to encourage, discourage negative campaigning, is going to make it easier for voters to avoid the role of spoiler and wasting their votes and splitting votes and being able to vote their true preferences. There are real issues to investigate once the dust settles on this about how easy or difficult ranked choice voting is in practice. And of course, that will take some time and experience to sort itself out, as with all reforms. But in any case, there's a lot at stake. There's great interest here and throughout the country in what happens in San Francisco. And there's no question this is a major reform that could spur others in the state and around the country.
Thank you, Rich DeLeon. Stephen Hill, you've been pushing this for years in San Francisco, successfully now it seems, because it will be tested in 1 week. Can you just tell us basically and show us, and for our radio audience, walk us through of how this will work and what you find the benefits are, why you're pushing this as a reform for elections?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I have a little spider that has been dancing on my microphone since Rich started talking. Oh, there it goes. There it is.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Rich, I'll pass it off to you. Wonderful. It's been fun watching it. I want to also thank Rich for his very kind and generous words. And Rich DeLeon has really been a great help to us in just in helping us look at data and understand what's going on in San Francisco, what the demographics are in San Francisco, and who might what might be the impacts of a system like ranked choice voting in San Francisco. So, and also his book, Left Coast City, is the finest book on San Francisco politics that you could ever read. Great title, too, Left Coast City. So, and there's a new version, new edition coming out soon, yeah?
Once I finish writing it.
An updated version that may include ranked choice voting, the recent mayoral race, everything. So, first thing I want to say is that the first ranked choice voting election has already happened in San Francisco. San Francisco Youth Commission sponsors an election called Youth Vote, where the high school students get to vote, and they vote on president and ballot measures and all these sorts of things. But they actually do one election that is actually a real public election, and that is they elect a non-voting delegate to the San Francisco School Board of Education. And they used ranked choice voting to do that just a couple weeks ago. We counted the ballots, hand-counted about 8,000 ballots. The incumbent won re-election. And it was really quite I think, exciting for people. We had about 12 volunteers helping to count the ballots, sorting them into piles and what have you. And it went off very smoothly. So San Francisco can take a deep breath. It's already happened, and it's over. And now we just have to do the next election in San Francisco this November 2nd. So what I thought I would do tonight is I'm going to actually do a version of the presentation that the Speakers Bureau that the Center for Voting and Democracy has created, and that also that organizations that are being funded by the Department of Elections, like Senior Action Network, Asian Law Caucus, and other organizations, are doing all over the city and have been doing for the last month and a half. And there's been dozens and dozens of speakers going out all over the city speaking to PTAs, church groups, labor unions, you know, pretty much any group that was willing to have us. We've been there doing the presentation, and it really goes through the very basics of ranked choice voting, shows you how you're going to vote using it, and then we actually do a small live election where you see how the ballots are counted. And so that way, I thought if we did that, for all of you who are having a lot of questions, it would be a good grounding and a place for all of us to have a good discussion about it. And for those on the radio, I think it will also be educational for them, too. So I'm going to do that. And also I have some handouts for you that I'll get going around. Maybe could someone help me with that? And one of these handouts, I should say, if you want to start those around, is a door hanger that we've created. And various campaigns are carrying this door hanger. It's very educational in nature. It just says ranked choice voting is here, what you need to know. And on both sides, it gives, the basic information. So lots of different techniques are being used for education around ranked choice voting as we try to make a transition smoothly going from what voters know and what is familiar to something that is new. In that light, a lot of what, when we give a presentation about it, we like to compare ranked choice voting, or it's sometimes known as instant runoff voting, to a runoff system, and comparing it in particular to the previous runoff system. And in that light, what you're really doing as a voter is you have a first choice, but then you also have your runoff choices are your second and third choices. Those, in essence, are your backup choices in case your first choice can't win. And so if you think of it in terms of the old runoff system that we have, what we're going to be doing this time is not that different. So, Rich, could you hang on to this for one second?
Sure.
And I'm just going to remind people that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we are speaking with Stephen Hill, founder and associate director of the Center on Voting and Democracy, and Dr. Richard DeLeung, professor of political science at San Francisco State University. The topic is ranked choice voting. It's going to be happening next week, San Francisco, for the November 2nd election for the races for Board of Supervisors. Stephen Hill is going to give us walk us through radio and for our viewing audience of how this is working.
Thank you, Rachel. So ranked choice voting, this is basically a PowerPoint that we've blown up onto 2x3 feet placards, and that we have several versions of them out, and speakers take these and show them on our presentation. So the first one, what is ranked choice voting? Ranked choice voting is simply a method of electing our office holders so that they have a support from a majority of voters and getting it over in a single election. That's really what this is about. And we have you do that by having you rank your first choice, second choice, and third choice. As I said earlier, you're ranking your runoff choices at the same time as your first choice. And this eliminates the need for a December runoff election. Who will be elected using ranked choice voting? This November 2nd, we're going to elect 7 seats on the Board of Supervisors, all the odd numbers, supervisors, and plus District 2, since District 2, we're filling a vacancy there. So that's districts 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, and 11, plus district 2. Okay? So that, and then in subsequent years, we'll elect the mayor, district attorney, city attorney, treasurer, assessor recorder, public defender, and sheriff using this system. So every year, there'll be at least one office, and some offices 2, and others 3, that will be elected using ranked choice voting in San Francisco. Ranked choice voting does not cover school board elections, community college board, or BART board. Those actually are governed by state law, and so you can't change how you elect them by making a change to the charter of San Francisco. Why use ranked choice voting? There's, just going over some of the reasons why San Francisco went to it and other cities might consider it. For one, you're getting rid of an unnecessary runoff election, a second election. You're saving millions of dollars. And actually, the latest estimates are that a citywide runoff election in San Francisco costs about $3 million for a citywide runoff. And then if you're just doing it for a few seats on the Board of Supervisors, it's less. So tax savings, candidates save money by not having to run a second election, so it's more supportive of campaign finance reform. The impact on one of the ones that's been getting a lot of attention lately is the impact on campaigns. With ranked choice voting, if you are a candidate, you may need to win by attracting the second or the third rankings from the supporters of other candidates, right? So that means you've got to be careful what you say about those candidates. You can't be out there trash-talking those candidates and tearing them down and doing hit pieces against them. I remember I live in District 4, the Sunset District in San Francisco. And in 2002, at this point in the elections, one candidate had already called the other a pornographer. Another candidate called another one a slum landlord. We were getting mailers with cockroaches and rats on them. And at one point, I got an automated phone message from the priest of one of the candidates who was saying, so-and-so is really a good guy. I've known him. He's been going to my church for years. Don't believe what his opponents are saying about him. I mean, that's how low it can get in San Francisco. I had never heard a priest actually calling up and supporting a candidate before. But that's what was happening in District 4. This time around, Not that there isn't some negative campaigning going on, but I think in most of the districts, it's a lot less than what it has been. And in other districts, you actually see, like in District 5, candidates actively courting each other's number two and number three rankings, doing fundraisers together, you know, indicating, in case I don't win, here's who I think should be your second choice, this sort of thing. So what that means is that the incentives for how you win with ranked choice voting are quite different. You win by building coalitions than necessarily by knocking down your opponent. And that, I think, has been new for San Francisco. It's been new for the candidates. It's especially been new for a lot of the political consultants who are really having a hard time dealing with this and trying to, they're just so used to, you know, you raise a lot of money, you load the cannon, and you fire. I mean, that's how they're used to running campaigns. And that kind of behavior actually can backfire on you with ranked choice voting. You want to run by finding common ground with other candidates and building coalitions. So those are just some of the reasons. There are others that you know, we can go into during question and answers, like getting the election over in November when voter turnout tends to be highest. In the 2000 runoff elections in December for Board of Supervisors, voter turnout dropped by 50% between the November election and the December election. So you essentially had two different electorates voting in those two different elections. Okay, so now this next visual for you, those of you on the radio, is actually a big blow-up of the San Francisco ballot, the ranked choice voting ballot, and what it's going to look like. And essentially what we're looking at here are the Optech Eagle ballot with three columns. The candidates' names are repeated three times in the columns. And for those of you that have the brochure that says ranked choice voting explained, if you open that up, the inside of that has a version of the ballot for you to look at. So the candidates' names are repeated in each column. Each column corresponds to one of your rankings. You have three rankings here. So for a voter, if you wanted, say, Cesar Chavez as your first choice, you would connect an arrow here, the arrow that's pointing to Cesar Chavez in the first column, and that would be your number one ranking. If you wanted Martin Luther King Jr. as your second choice, you would connect the arrow pointing to Martin Luther King Jr. in the second column, and that would be your second choice. And if you wanted Eleanor Roosevelt as your third choice, you would connect the arrow pointing to Eleanor Roosevelt. That would be your third choice. And that's pretty much, that's it in terms of how you mark your ballot. Now, this next panel, in some ways, is the most important panel of the presentation, and it's called Guidelines for Voters. These are the things that you really need to know as a voter, and so I'm going to read these for you, and I'm going to go into each one of these in a little bit more detail, but I'm just going to go through the three of them first. The first one is rank three candidates, okay? The second one is make sure you rank three different candidates. You do not want to rank the same candidate three times, or you don't want to just rank one candidate and leave your other two rankings blank. And I will talk more about why that is. The third is that it's best to use all of your rankings. Those are the three things that you as a voter want to remember going into the voter's booth. And did the door hanger get passed out? Did this get passed out? Mm-hmm. On the back of that, it has guidelines for voters there. It's a kind of a similar version of that, so take a look at that. So now I'm going to go into each one of these in a little bit more detail. Voters, rank your candidates. Under the old December runoff system, voters just picked one choice, but with this system, you actually are ranking your candidates first choice, second choice, third choice, and we're going to use your rankings as your runoff rankings to determine the winner who has a majority of the election in one election. Second one, rank three different candidates. The thing to remember is that ranking a second and a third choice will not hurt your first choice. Your lower choices can't help defeat your higher choices, because by the time your vote gets to your second choice, for instance, it means your first choice is already lost. Your vote will always stay with your first choice as long as your first choice is in the race, okay? So once you know that, that means you are free to vote for your second choice, if you wish, and your third choice. I mean, think of it this way. In the 2000 presidential election, the 100,000 voters that voted for Ralph Nader in Florida would have had the option of ranking their second choice. There's no question that thousands of them would have ranked Al Gore. Their vote would have stayed with Ralph Nader as long as Ralph Nader was in the race. But once it was determined that Ralph Nader doesn't have enough votes to win and he's eliminated in the process of counting the ballots, now all the voters that put Ralph Nader as their first choice their vote would go to their second choice, their runoff choice, their backup choice, you know, whatever you want to call it. And then their vote goes to their second choice. No question, Al Gore would have been the recipient of thousands of runoff votes, and he would have won Florida and the presidency if we'd used ranked choice voting or instant runoff voting in the 2000 presidential election. So your lower choice can't help defeat your higher choice, so you don't want to worry about not ranking a second or third choice or bullet voting, as it's sometimes called, where you just rank one choice. You can feel liberated. You as a voter now can pick the candidate you really like as your first choice. You know, you may want to vote for your Aunt Mimi because she's honest, she always tells the truth, and you know, she would be a good office holder, you think. But in case she can't win, you vote for a more realistic choice as your second or third choice. That's really what we're talking about here, okay? So that's important to know. And then the third one, again, it's best to use all of your rankings for the same reasons I've already said. Your lower choices can't help defeat your higher choices, so there's no reason not to use your all three of your rankings. So that means, going back to the visuals of the ballot, here now we're looking at the ballot again with the three columns. It means that you don't want to rank the same candidate three times. Because let's say on your ballot, if your favorite choice was Cesar Chavez, and you say, I like Cesar Chavez so much, I'm going to rank him three times. Well, what that means is that if Cesar Chavez gets eliminated from the race, it means you don't have a second choice anymore. You don't have a runoff choice because he gets eliminated in all three of the rankings when you pick him. Okay? So similarly, if you were to just bullet vote, as it's sometimes called, which means just pick one candidate, say Martin Luther King Jr. as your number one choice and no second or third choice, that doesn't help Martin Luther King Jr., and it doesn't use your ballot most effectively. You can rank a second and third choice knowing that those choices can't help defeat Martin Luther King Jr. Okay? So that's really what we're talking about here.
Thank you, Stephen. And again, just a reminder that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And we are speaking with Stephen Hill, founder and associate director of the Center on Voting and Democracy, and Dr. Richard DeLeong, professor of political science at San Francisco State University. And the issue is ranked choice voting. We do have some questions. This is just a procedural one. I don't know what the answer is. I'm curious. How do you vote for a write-in candidate on the ranked choice ballot?
Actually, I think the demonstration ballot had an example. So does the brochure. And it's actually the same way as you would normally. You write in the candidate's name, but as the supporters of Terry Baum, the Green Party candidate, learned, you not only have to write in the person's name, but with this particular Optech Eagle ballot, you have to connect the arrow. You must do both in order for it to count. And you would just do it in each column, depending on what ranking you wanted to give to that write-in candidate. So it works pretty much the same ways that it always has.
Great. Rich DeLeong, can you answer this? Who opposes ranked choice voting and why?
Who opposes it?
Yeah, it's been a fight in San Francisco politically. A lot of people didn't want it. Who are those folks who didn't want this new system to be put in place?
I think first of all, I think just generally, whenever there's a fairly major reform or change, it's uncomfortable and difficult and strange. And just on those grounds, there's often resistance out of inertia. My grandpa used to say, when I used to whine and complain, if you're comfortable, you're probably not learning anything. And so I think there's some discomfort, and people have to learn new things, and it's difficult, especially those in the more activist community and the consultants community who have invested often many years to develop their savvy and sense of the rules of the game, and then suddenly all those rules seem to go out the window and they got to learn new tricks. So just generally it's difficult, I think, for everybody, but especially for those folks who have some investment in the system to learn to deal with it and change. I think there are certain very legitimate concerns and reservations from those in racial, ethnic minority communities and language minority communities and new voters and naturalized immigrant groups with a whole new process that might require a very careful community outreach and education program to deal with. And there's some reservations about that. And during the process of implementing this reform, there were actual lawsuits to obstruct the implementation, partly out of the uncertainty and concerns for how this might disadvantage certain communities. And then some just on principle. There are a number of San Franciscans who just really like the old, you know, head-on runoff election. You know, they prefer to not invest a lot of time in learning the whole list of candidates and to let it get whittled down and then to show up in the runoff and decide which of the two facing off deserve the vote. And in fact, not everyone dislikes negative campaigning. Some really do like it. They would prefer to know you know what the bad stuff is and to have it all turned up and exposed. And they think that's actually a good thing in a healthy democracy. And some of that is lost, you know, in this more congenial, harmonious kind of system. So those are some of the groups.
Let me ask you a little bit about the negative campaigning. We are seeing in District 5, as you said, that there's a lot more working together amongst the candidates, 22 candidates running for that one seat that has been held by Matt Gonzalez, but he's not running for re-election. But we've also seen in District 1, the Richmond District, and District 11, where Supervisor Gerardo Sandoval is the incumbent, and the Excelsior and Outer Mission, where there's been some very vicious attacks, particularly on the incumbent candidates. Isn't that business as usual? What's different, if anything, about this new system, or has it not resonated in those two areas yet? Stephen Hill.
Well, yeah, I've been watching both of those races with a great deal of interest. A couple of thoughts I'll offer on them. I would say that the opponents of the incumbent, Jake McGoldrick, in District 1 have done quite a good job of building coalitions, all with each other, against the incumbent. And they have made a calculation that they need, their only chance of beating the incumbent is to basically work together, and they are doing that. If you think back to the previous December runoff system, there would have been a completely different calculation going on there. The three who are teamed up would have been able to have to figure out, okay, which one of us is going to get into the runoff with Jake McGoldrick? And at that point, their main opponents become each other. Okay. If you think back to the mayoral election, for instance, you had Gavin Newsom, and then you had four sort of progressive candidates. We used the old system, the December runoff system, in that election, and so the main opponents of the progressives all became each other, because they had to figure out which one of us is going to get in the runoff against Gavin Newsom. So the candidates, in other words, who had the most alike, were the most going after each other. So you had Angela Alioto doing a hit piece against Matt Gonzalez. You had Matt Gonzalez doing a hit piece against Tom Amiano. Okay. So now with this new system, if we had used it in the mayoral race, they would have been acting very differently, and we're seeing that in District 1. The other thing I would say is that I think that Jake McGoldrick's campaign has actually failed to build a coalition. You know, they got stuck in the old mindset of how you win in San Francisco. You just run a campaign, you run hard, and, you know, like from what I hear, he's now doing some negative campaigning himself. And, his advisors did not reach out to these other candidates in District 1 and try to build their own coalition. And I think that that's an example of people not yet quite getting up to speed on the new paradigm.
Okay, let me ask you about the mayor's race last year. How would this have affected the Newsom-Gonzalez race for mayor 2003? Would the outcome have been different, or have we not figured this out yet? Either of you have an idea?
Well, it's all
Stephen Hill.
It's all sort of hindsight, but I think that if we had used ranked choice voting, the outcome would have been the same. I mean, Gavin Newsom, you know, if you look at the results in the November election and you figure those as the number one rankings, Gavin Newsom had a great lead. 42%, and that's hard to overcome. I think Gonzalez did quite a good job of trying to do that. Ultimately, lost by 6 percentage points. But you never know. The progressive candidates would have been campaigning differently. They would have been campaigning more as a team instead of, as I said, sniping at each other to see which one is going to be in the runoff. Matt Gonzalez did have some difficulty uniting the progressive candidates around him after it had been so bitter between them all. Angela Alioto ended up endorsing Gavin Newsom instead of Gonzalez. So, again, it's hard to say, but my sense is that the results would have been the same.
Okay. There seems to be a lot of head scratching right now coming up in these supervisors' races. It doesn't seem that the pollsters quite have their pulse on what's going on. Is there a way, I mean, as reporters, we like to know who's ahead and who might win. A lot of voters like to know whether they're going to have to push harder for the underdog, or do they just go to the person who's a perceived winner. Is there a way that we can do pre-election calculations under ranked choice voting of who the winner might be, or is it just something that we'll have to live with what the results are on election night?
Well,
Rich DeLeon.
No, I think the change is going to change everything else. Decides to run for office, how they run their campaigns, and it's going to change how things operate in the community of consultants and pollsters and journalists who cover it. It changes everything. For example, polling. I think now there are always polls done, sometimes paid for by the candidates, sometimes independent. Even the way polling is done now has to include, these options of ranked choices for second and third and so on, and take all of that into account in order to get some bead on how the outcome is likely to turn out. So I think that's a key factor. But, going back to the earlier question, I think there's no doubt, slam dunk, under ranked choice voting, Gavin Newsom would have won. And I think that is one reason a lot of folks in the activist progressive community in San Francisco have some strong reservations, because they will point to that election and say, see, we would not have had the privilege of this terrific battle between Gavin Newsom and Matt Gonzalez, which was very exciting and thrilling for a lot of people, especially on the left in San Francisco. It would have just been, everything would have been worked out in the computer in 23 seconds, and Gavin Newsom anointed and declared the winner. And so they'd say, we're going to miss the opportunity to have those kind of exciting runoffs, new faces. It'll all be done in this other way. But then as Stephen was just saying, you can't just go back and assume that history would have the same trajectory. Everything would have been different, including the campaigning among progressives, and you might have had a totally different outcome.
Stephen, you've been out in the community a lot doing these workshops and working with other groups, I suppose, on how to put together these workshops. Have you found any communities in particular, whether it's geographic in San Francisco or ethnic or age, that are not getting it yet, that there's still a lot more work to do for education, that you have to go out again and again or do some other kind of outreach method for them?
We find that most voters, when they see the presentation, get it. It's a question is getting out to enough people so enough people have seen the presentation. There's no question on election day a certain number of voters are going to be walking in completely cold. They have never heard of ranked choice voting. They have no clue about ranking their candidates. In fact, they've already done early voting where that was the case. But the interesting thing that was what was interesting to me in reading the reports of that is that when told, well, you're now supposed to rank your candidates, all the early voters were able to do it. And that's the thing that I like to point out, is that ranking candidates is not that hard to do, and ranking things in general. I mean, Americans love to rank things, sports teams, movies, whatever. It's just a new context. And so ranking itself is not difficult. It's just putting that expectation out there so that voters know that's what they have to do. So I would expect on election day we're going to see a certain amount of confusion. Hopefully all the education that's been going on in the Department of Elections has had $800,000 to spend to try and educate the community, which isn't a huge amount of money for the city the size of San Francisco, but it's a good amount to at least get some recognition out there. But I also remember in 2000, when we first introduced the optical scan voting equipment that we have now, we got away from the punch cards in that election. There was a lot of confusion that year as well. Anytime you go to a new change like this, there's going to be some confusion, and I would expect that that's going to happen on
election day. Do you think there will be patience in San Francisco if there is some confusion in this election, or do you think if there are any problems that people might go, see, it doesn't work, we've got to go back to the old way, or do you think there really is a momentum in the city to make sure that the system that the voters approved makes sure that it works? Give it a second try or a third try.
Well,
Rich DeLeon.
Well, at least speaking for myself, I really do hope San Franciscans give it a fair chance and more than just one election. And I mentioned the case of Ann Arbor, where the very next year it was repealed because a lot of interests were threatened. I just want to remind those, especially San Franciscans who love the district election system, that just weeks before the first district elections in San Francisco since 1979, in November 2000, half of the voters surveyed did not even know that things had changed the district elections. And of that 50%, about half of them did not know what district they were in. And that's just, again, weeks before the election. And I'm sure a lot of defenders of the district election system would gasp at the idea of repealing it. And partly that's because people now have had some practice with it over two or three elections and are familiar with it and know what district they're in and know how the game is played. And I think the same kind of chance and the same time needs to be given this reform to give it a fair chance to succeed.
Yeah, and you know, if I could just add to that, in terms of the opponents of this system, and there are people who are waiting for the opportunity to repeal it, the main opposition in terms of the money that was spent to stop it from passing came from political consultants and their supporters, the political industry, I would call them, because they make money from elections. And so getting rid of an election to them was a direct pocketbook interest. And they were doing tactics in the campaign where we passed this to, for instance, they did a mailer to Chinese voters where they had the famous photo with the man in Tiananmen Square, the lone man standing in front of the tank in Tiananmen Square. And it said, if Proposition A passes, something about your right to vote will be taken away. And then they did another mailer to women, targeted to women, that had a Now March on it. And Dolores Huerta was in the photo, and Patricia Ireland. Something about, if Proposition A passes, you'll be losing your choice. The problem is that San Francisco Now had endorsed Proposition A, the instant runoff measure, as had Dolores Huerta and Patricia Ireland. So the opponents of this knew no shame. They were willing to do anything, to spend any amount. They had printers printing campaign material at cost, because the printers make money on elections too. So that's where the attack is going to come, from political consultants. And just recently in the Examiner, Jack Davis, a rather notorious political consultant in San Francisco, was quoted saying all sorts of silly things about ranked choice voting, things that had no factual basis at all, but basically showing his hostility to the system. So that's where we can expect the attack to come, is from that quarter.
Now, Stephen, when after voters approved this new system, it took quite a while for it to be put in place in San Francisco, and I know you were wary or skeptical, I can't quite think of the right word, of whether city officials, particularly at the Department of Elections, were serious enough to make sure that this system goes forward. Are you confident now that elections officials in San Francisco do want to make sure this works and it works well?
Yes, I am. I think the Department of Elections last few months has been working hard. You know, it did take a while to get things kind of on track, but now that they're on track, I see them working hard from an operational standpoint. I've observed lots of the stages in the implementation of this, including the federal and state testing, the logic and accuracy tests, as they're called, where they actually test the accuracy of the equipment, the poll worker training. And I think they're thinking this through very much from an operational standpoint to make it a good election. So.
Okay, let's talk about state and national. There's a question from the audience. Are there any constitutional hurdles to ranked choice voting spreading to statewide or nationwide elections?
You would do that.
Stephen Hill again.
No, there are no constitutional issues. One of the things that gets raised sometimes is this is a violation of one person, one vote, because voters get to rank first choice, second choice, third choice, which would be a constitutional issue if that were the case. But, I mean, when you think about it, the school board elections that we have in San Francisco and that they have all over the state of California, you have, for four seats on the Board of Supervisors, every voter has four votes. So it's not really one person, one vote in a literal sense, though it is in a legal sense, because that's not, there's a lot of misunderstanding of what that term of art means, according to the Supreme Court. And the ranked choice voting system, actually in the Ann Arbor situation, first the opponents that wanted to get rid of it before they mounted a repeal attempt, first they took it to court. And the Michigan State Supreme Court ruled that there was no violation of one person, one vote. So that would be some case law in another state indicating that there's no constitutional issues. In fact, we could use instant runoff voting if we wanted to in the state of California for our presidential election. It would just take a change in state law, and we could use instant runoff voting. Voters could be ranking their first choice, second choice, third choice for California for presidential elections, as well as Senate, Congress, state assembly, state senate, all these sorts of things.
Is there any push underway right now in California to change to this system? Or is it really going from city to city at this point?
I would
point?
Say it's more of a city-to-city kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, you have a lot of emerging advocacy groups like Californians for Electoral Reform, for example, very active in the Greater Bay Area and some chapters in Southern California. So there's some real mobilization around it in public education. That will lay the groundwork, you know, for, you know, more reform later. But I just want to say, adding on to what Stephen just said, that the The Florida 2000 presidential election fiasco, I think, had a silver lining, namely that it opened the hood on the greasy and grimy electoral machinery the way it really works, and that this is a human process and involves choice. And I think a lot of voters had no idea. They had no idea of the variety of different ways that people ran in elections and counted votes and the technology involved. And I think it restored a sense of choice, an empowering sense of choice to voters around the country. And something that was accepted as just part of the natural landscape actually is a product of human choice and the democratic process. And I think probably that feeling is going to spread, I'm pretty sure, at the end of this coming presidential election.
Okay, a couple of quick kind of technical questions that probably be short answers for this. Is it possible for a race to have no majority winner after three rounds of tabulations? If so, how is that race resolved?
The way it's defined in the charter, it's a majority of what's called continuing ballots. Continuing ballot, by definition, is a ballot that's still in play. All the choices have not been exhausted, in other words. And what I mean by exhausted ballot is, like, if you have three different rankings, first choice, second choice, third choice, and they all those people lose, at that point your ballot no longer is in play. So the actually, in a mathematical sense, the denominator in figuring out the majority starts decreasing at a certain point, okay? But this is no different, again, than the way we did the December runoff election. If you think about it, in the 2000 December runoff election, the winners actually had about anywhere from 25 to 30% of the vote compared to the voters who came out in the original November election when you had a much higher voter turnout. In any type of runoff system, it's always a majority of the voters who are present in the final election, not the initial count in that race. So a majority is defined as a majority of continuing ballots.
Now, you showed us how the ballots are counted, but really, how are they counted? Is there people doing this counting, or is it a machine that's doing it? Is there special software that had to be developed?
There are little mice. There are little mice, and they run on a treadmill, and
don't tell PETA about that. ballots counted? It's special software.
It's software, yeah, and it's not very complicated software. The tabulation is pretty straightforward and simple. You saw how it works, and the way we just did the example earlier, it works that way whether you have 21 ballots or 100,000 ballots, or five candidates or 22 candidates. It works exactly the same. And so from the time when the Department of Elections hits the button, so to speak, on the computer that's going to count the ballots, it'll take about 3 minutes per supervisorial race to finish the tabulation. It's really fast. In a citywide race with a couple hundred thousand ballots, it would take about 7 minutes.
Still may not be, as I understand, an instantaneous results, perhaps, because there are still going to be the provisional ballots or the contested ballots that have to be counted and absentees that might be coming in that day.
Yes.
So, like past elections, we aren't going to know in 3 minutes necessarily who the winner is, right?
Right. It's the 3 minutes once they have all the ballots processed. And so, because of the high number of absentee ballots in San Francisco elections and all of California elections now, I mean, they're figuring anywhere from 30 to 35% of voters will be voting by absentee. And you have to wait until you have all those ballots before you can do the final official tally. But the Department of Elections is going to be doing kind of snapshot tallies each day after they process the next batch of absentee ballots. So we'll be able to have a running idea of where the race is.
Okay, I'm going to, on our last question now from then, I'm going to reach across to the East Bay, where the Registrar of Voters for Alameda County said, boy, we're just not ready for this system yet. As you mentioned earlier, that they want to see what happens in San Francisco. What should they be looking for San Francisco? What message is there? Be patient. We'll get it right. Is it a system that can work? That, as you said earlier in an article that you had, Stephen, that it's Seattle, New York, other cities are looking to this. So what should they be looking for to say yes or no to this system in their jurisdiction?
They should be looking at whether San Francisco has its Decembers back from now on, which we will. We won't be going to the polls in December. We'll have winners in all the races, and that's really what it's about, and whether the results are considered legitimate, which there's no reason why they shouldn't be, because they'll be the candidates preferred by the most voters in those races, and You know, that's really what it's about. I mean, Rich might have some thoughts.
Well, and I think these election evaluation studies that I mentioned earlier by San Francisco State and KVEC and other groups, you know, careful, systematic studies will, you know, in their conclusions and findings will bear on that too. I'm really happy that these studies are being done that go beyond just impressionistic or observational or anecdotal kind of evidence.
All right. Well, I guess the other message is to voters coming up for Tuesday in San Francisco, pay attention. Enjoy being in San Francisco, where we're ahead of the curve a lot of times. And that's going to wrap up our program tonight. I'd like to thank Stephen Hill, the founder and associate director of the Center on Voting and Democracy, and Dr. Richard DeLeung, professor of political science at San Francisco State University, for their comments here tonight. We also like to thank our audiences here and on the radio. And now, the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 100th and first year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you very much for joining us.